Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your questions, either via email or phone calls. Well, I'll be giving out those phone numbers in just a few minutes. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So let's start out with a really interesting, simple intervention that may have profound implications for improving the survival of premature babies. This is something that has been a shift in obstetric management over the last few decades, I'd say. The idea that maybe we shouldn't just cut that cord quite so quickly. There's a lot of good stuff in that umbilical cord blood, and maybe it's intended to be allowed to drain into the baby. And that's been happening, well, very widely in term babies, but there's been some concern about premature babies and whether or not in a premature birth you should wait to cut the cord. This is a study that was published recently last week out of Baylor. 148 babies less than 32 weeks gestation. That's almost 2 months early. And these are very, very frail infants. One of the chief complications that they experience is intraventricular hemorrhage, bleeding into the brain. Well, the Baylor's research found that waiting for 45 seconds, that seemed to be the magic number, before clamping the cord, reduced intraventricular hemorrhages in premature infants by almost 50%. There were also fewer cases of needs for early red blood cell transfusions. How long to keep the cord open? Well, babies whose cords were open for more than 60 seconds had more jaundice. So there's probably a magic length there, and that magic length is around 45 seconds. Thank goodness there's a big analog clock on the clubhouse wall of just about every hospital out there. So now, let's go on to talk about Huntington's disease. Now, Huntington's disease is one of those really horrible hereditary illnesses. People with Huntington's will experience in middle age the onset of strange movement disorders, sort of jerky motions that they can't control. And then after that, they develop dementia and emotional lability. But such a horrible, horrible disease. It's really a meltdown. And symptoms don't occur until after you've reproduced. This is caused by an autosomal dominant gene. So if you inherit the gene from your parent, you're likely to get the disease. And one of the chief questions is, well, when and how soon? But what's going on here? Well, this is another one of those autophagy failures, like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. Huntington's is an accumulation of a toxic protein in the brain. And so the toxic protein itself is called Huntingtin, obvious reasons. And there have been a couple of therapies looking at whether or not we might be able to help with the accumulation of this toxic protein. And researchers at the University of British Columbia recently began measuring the levels of this mutant Huntington protein in the cerebral spinal fluid. And they found that they could use, they've invented an ultra-sensitive test that will allow the amounts of this protein to be detected. This comes just as gene silencing therapy is coming on board. And gene silencing therapy is, something we talked about a few months ago, among other things. You can use particularly targeted small interfering microRNAs. Remember that? And the idea is the gene for the Huntington's, which contains an abnormal number of repeats of a sequence. So essentially, you've got your regular piece of DNA, And then stuck in that DNA, there's a stutter, CAG, CAG, CAG. A normal version of this Huntington protein has perhaps 6 repeats. And if you've got more than 35 repeats, you will develop accumulation of this protein. It can't be broken down. It's not shaped correctly. People with 40 to 55 repeats develop Huntington's disease with 100% certainty. And the question is just a matter of when. With gene silencing therapy, we'll be able to take a small piece of tailored RNA, and after this flawed gene is transcribed, it heads out of the nucleus to be manufactured. At that point, our targeted mRNA can jump on it. And so the RNA will block the transcription of the gene and prevent the protein from being created in the first place. Thus, you can't accumulate abnormal levels of something you don't make. Gene silencing therapy has great promise, not just for fairly rare diseases like Huntington's, but also fairly common ones like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's. We are poised on the threshold of something very, very new. Just also another story about Huntington's disease. This one, a genome-wide association study looking at 4,000 different Huntington's patients and looking at when did they get sick and what were the factors, the other genetic factors that seemed to influence that. And these researchers have identified at least 3 and possibly 4 other sites on different chromosomes. Now, the Huntington is on chromosome 4, but there are 2 sites on chromosome 15 that strongly influence disease onset. One hastens the disease by about 6 years, and the other slows it by about 1.5 years. Now, those are on the average, so when you think about a population of 4,000, obviously there's going to be a great deal of variation there. So if we can study the genes that are helping and possibly figure out what they're doing and amplify that, something that has also become possible in this brave new world of genetic manipulation, well, anything's possible. Let's go to an email. This first one from Alicia in Iowa. An antibiotic to improve the gut microbiome. First, thanks for your wonderful program and your recent suggestions on what to eat to help create a healthy gut microbiome. This is of particular interest to me because I have had gut issues. I'm a 35-year-old woman, and I wish I'd known more about gut microbiota 10 years ago. Unwisely, when I was 23, I began 2 years or more of daily low-dose minocycline to control acne. A couple of years later, I started having symptoms of food sensitivity. Then at about 27, I began having acute GI symptoms, nothing but diarrhea for 9 months, about 7 pounds weight loss during this time. So then one day I gave up gluten, and within 24 hours I was back to normal stools, making it more like an intolerance than celiac, although I do have some transparency in my teeth and have tested positive for the genetic propensity for celiacs, and that would be the DQ2 and the DQ8 human histocompatibility antigens that are on the surface of all our cells, the so-called organ tissue matching antigens. Anyway, back to Alicia. I've been on a strictly gluten-free diet since 2008, but I still often feel rather sick and still have some issues, loose stools and diarrhea on occasion, which went away when I was pregnant. I went to see a GI doctor at our town who thought it sounded like an irritable bowel syndrome and suggested that an antibiotic, I believe called Xifaxan, might be helpful for rebalancing the gut. I was wondering if you've heard of this, and would you recommend an antibiotic for healing the gut? Is it possible to treat bad bacteria overgrowth just through diet? And if this antibiotic would be a good course, what supplements would you recommend taking during and after the treatment to help the good bacteria gain the upper hand? Also, a bit of a side question, how would one know if they had a leaky gut? Alicia, thank you for a wonderful question and a very succinct description of some of, I think, the key issues here are very well outlined. So let me start with saying that I'm very happy that the gastroenterologists are beginning to actually suggest manipulation of the microbiome. I worry a bit that their understanding of it is primarily coming from the pharmaceutical company that's educating them about the very expensive proprietary drug Xifaxan, and maybe leaving out a few of the other details. This is not a disease that you treat with an antibiotic, and that kind of simplistic thinking will help some people, but it may actually make some people worse. So it's a nuanced answer. First of all, on that leaky gut, there are some tests that can be done. You can drink a compound that has a sugar called lactulose in it. Lactulose is a big molecule, shouldn't be able to get into your system. It should stay in the gut. So if it comes out in your urine, then you know that you are absorbing it, which means you have a leaky gut. So that's a quick and dirty test for leaky gut that's widely available. I also will use food sensitivity testing quite a lot. And given what you've said, looking at an IgG panel, those are offered by a number of alternative medicine laboratories. You have Genova, Meridian Labs, both have good tests. And these tests will look for a type of antibody in your bloodstream. And obviously, you shouldn't have high levels of food antibody in your bloodstream unless that food is being manifested to your bloodstream, in which case you have a leaky gut. So when I see a diffuse pattern of positives in an individual, I can make that diagnosis. Food sensitivity will lead to a leaky gut. A leaky gut will lead to food sensitivity. It's a real chicken and egg problem. And you've obviously got food sensitivities because you have such a strong reaction to gluten that you've established. And there's probably other foods as well. The Xifaxan primarily is useful when you have a bacterial overgrowth, where there's too many bacteria, or when you have really severe pathogens. And I primarily reserve it for people who get a lot of bloating immediately after meals, particularly starchy meals. And I'll have someone go on a what's called a FODMAPS, F-O-D-M-A-P-S. The exact acronym escapes me, but essentially these are foods that have low levels of fermentable polysaccharides. In other words, the stuff that the good bacteria want to eat will be low, and therefore none of the bacteria will ferment the food, so you get reduced bloating. And if bloating is a prominent aspect of your symptoms, then indeed treating a bacterial overgrowth might be useful. Before I prescribe Xifaxan, which I think is a very strong and disruptive agent, and sometimes you do need a strong and disruptive agent, I will do a hydrogen and methane breath test. And this is where you will eat something that is fermentable, usually in a beverage, and then breathe into a little balloon every half hour, and you track the amount of methane and hydrogen that's coming out in your lungs. That's a very good indicator of how actively the bacteria in your gut are fermenting and creating these gases, which are not a part of human physiology in terms of the breakdown of these disaccharides. So break down sugar yourself, you're doing it in a way that doesn't generate these gases. If there's bacteria doing it, these gases go up in your bloodstream and can be measured. If that's positive, then treatment with that agent would be good. I would look at your situation and probably emphasize more going on an elimination diet. You can find that on my website at askdrdawn.com in the resources page. So you might want to take a look at that and try that for a few weeks. And then if you're finding that is reducing your symptoms of diarrhea, then it's a matter of systematically adding those foods back one at a time, maybe a little bit the first day and a normal amount the second day and a lot the third day, and then hang out for a few days and wait and see if you get that diarrhea and cramping. And if you do, then that's a food you need to avoid. Hope that's been helpful, and thanks very much for a really nice email allowing me to cover a lot of topics. Let's go now to, there was a question from Carrie in Capitola about eczema. And, Dear Dr. Dawn, I listen to your program regularly and love it. Thank you so much for doing what you do. My daughter has eczema on the front of her legs and her back. There are places on her skin where it feels like there are small bumps. It almost looks like goosebumps. I'm assuming this is eczema. Some people say this is due to gluten. Do you have any information on the cause of this eczema, or is it harmful to her body in other ways, besides not looking so good on her legs? Well, Carrie, it sounds a little bit like a condition called keratitis pilaris, which is where the follicles, the hair follicles, get clogged with keratin, and they do look like goosebumps, but they're not red, and they're not scale. They're rough, but they're not scaly. So, eczema is usually red and kind of flaky. So, if from what you're describing, I think you might actually have the keratitis pilaris, and that is associated with zinc deficiency or omega-3 fatty acid deficiency. So it would be worthwhile to take extra zinc and omega-3 fatty acids for about a month and see whether or not that changed the skin. You want to give 30 days for a skin change to happen. And in terms of adult dosing, if I were going to give adult doses for those supplements, I'd probably use about 15 milligrams of zinc and 2,000 milligrams of the omega-3s. So to figure out what to give a child, this is a rule of thumb, but certainly with supplements, it makes sense to use body weight. So you take your child's weight and divide by 150 pounds, and then whatever that number is, whether it's one-third or two-thirds, then you multiply that by the doses I just supplied. So for example, if your child weighed 50 pounds, then it would be 50 pounds divided by 150. So that's one-third, and so it would be one-third of 15 milligrams of zinc or 5 milligrams of zinc. And that's how you calculate a pediatric supplement dose when you don't have any data. You just use the adult body weight. And for supplements, this is going to work. You don't want to try this with pharmaceuticals. That's why we do experiments to determine pharmaceutical pediatric dosing, because it's not necessarily linear. But you're pretty safe with a food to use, food or a nutrient to use that kind of a rough calculation. But we're going to go to our first caller now, and that's Jerry in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jerry. Welcome.
Good morning, Dawn.
Good morning.
I have a question for you about sleep and aging.
Okay.
All through my life, I was a great sleeper. Go to sleep at 11 o'clock, wake up at 7:15 in the morning, refreshed. Two or three times a year, I'd wake up during the night and go right back to sleep. And that changed in my 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two different things that happen or scenarios is, one is I commonly wake up much earlier, like 5:30 to 6:30. And the other thing is if I wake up, that I wake up more frequently during the night. Obviously, one of those issues is prostate. But I also find that I've hurt my shoulders over the years, and I sleep on my side. And if I take something like naproxen before I go to sleep, then my shoulders don't ache, and then I don't wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to just find out, how does the body change in terms of the needs for sleep as you age, things that wake us up that are unwelcome,
yeah,
and how to mitigate all of that.
Well, the first thing is that we do tend to sleep less as we get older, but that isn't a good thing. You probably want about, as an elder, some to try to get, elder meaning over 50, at least seven hours. You know, the sweet spot's probably 7.5. There's some data that says if you sleep more than 8.5 hours, that there might be some mortality hit. But I have a feeling that's just a fluke based on comorbidities and other illnesses that I don't think the sleep is necessarily causal there. There's lots of things that interfere with sleep as we age, and because you're a male and you're in your 50s when it happened, I would strongly urge you to get your testosterone levels back in line, because that's a really common reason. In women, it's the estrogen going off. In men, the testosterone drops. And these are brain chemicals. They're not just sex hormones. They have fairly profound feedback loops in the brain, and a lot of the feedback loops relate to sleep. We see a phenomenon in brainwaves that occurs in middle-aged and older individuals in that their hearing becomes more acute at night. Ordinarily, your ears kind of turn off at night. There's a brainwave pattern called a sleep spindle that actually seems to impair brain perception of sound, and that evaporates with aging and has a strong correlation with having a harder time staying asleep, particularly early morning awakening, because, you know, you're probably hearing bird song just before sunrise, and that will it wakes up the plants, and they open up their little stomata. Did you know that plants hear bird song? I think that's so cool. But anyway, so earplugs might be helpful, and I would definitely get a serum testosterone and really go for, you know, really consider supplementation for a couple of months as a trial to see if it fixes your sleep if you come in low. Or even if you come in borderline, you know, because you may have been a guy who ran a testosterone of 800 and now you're running a testosterone of 300. And while that's normal, it may not be right. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So how does one restore testosterone? I thought that there were questions about with estrogen replacement therapy and all of that for women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the same thing goes for men in terms of prostate issues.
Well, actually, if you look at prostate cancer across the board and measure testosterone levels, the men with the lowest testosterone have the most prostate cancer. So it's clearly not a slam dunk that testosterone is bad for the prostate. What makes the prostate grow larger is something called dihydrotestosterone. And so that's that is a growth hormone for the prostate in the way that estrogen is a growth hormone for the breast. And if you have prostate cancer or you have breast cancer and it has testosterone or estrogen receptors respectively, well, then obviously it's really dumb to give testosterone or estrogen in those circumstances. But it is by no means established, and in fact, there's plenty of contradictory evidence that tells me that it's a complex dynamic and it's nonlinear, that as far as testosterone causing prostate cancer, or for that matter, even causing prostate hypertrophy. So there's probably, let's just to say that it's complicated and not as direct as the warnings that you might read on the Mayo Clinic website would lead you to believe. And I have a lot of additional expertise on natural hormone therapy, and I really think people can benefit from supplementation. But it's not like, you know, go online, go and order something off of eBay. I mean, I really think you want to work with someone who knows what they're doing and monitor your levels. But and I don't like testosterone injections, just like I don't like 50,000 units of vitamin D once a week. I think that if we're going to mess with hormones, you want to mimic what the body does with them and not treat it like a pharmaceutical, because it isn't.
Well, that's interesting. I always assumed that adding testosterone as you age was not a good idea. So can you say more about that?
Well, not everyone's testosterone drops, for one thing. And there are a lot of things that happen in the body that, when your testosterone does drop, that set you up for the kind of lifestyle, quote-unquote lifestyle aging diseases that we see in Western civilization. So we're talking, for example, about diabetes. And that one definitely, if you have low testosterone, you're much more likely to develop loss of muscles. And as you lose muscle and gain body fat and get a gut, you start to have this visceral adipose tissue generating hormones in your body, 17 biologically active hormones as it happens, all of which tend to push you in the direction of more weight gain and more insulin resistance and thicker blood that clots more readily. None of these are good from a cardiovascular standpoint. So this is part of the reason that I think testosterone supplementation, you know, at reasonable levels, we're not talking bodybuilder levels here, and most of the complications that you read about, including the ones I have in my consent form, are complications that are in the literature because of people injecting testosterone once a week to build muscle for bodybuilding purposes. Because they're, you know, a baseball pitcher or something like that. And yeah, they get testicular shrinkage and they get increased red blood cell mass. And it's kind of like, yeah, if you overdose on these things, you're going to get a lot of side effects. But I think the data on anti-aging, or, you know, what we're all aging, I guess, so it's better to say healthy aging and aging as slowly as possible. There's pretty good evidence that judicious hormone supplementation is probably beneficial. You know, bone mass is the other thing. So diabetes and bone mass. Yeah. And in terms of cardiovascular, you've got to watch the lipids in males anyway. But in a person with normal lipids, there's no increased cardiovascular risk unless they become polycythemic. In other words, nobody's minding the store and monitoring these people properly. And then, yeah, in that group, you do see an increased heart attack rate because their blood is thick. And so they get more clotting.
Interesting. Coming back to what you were saying before about the dampening of hearing that normally happens, is there a similar thing for visual, that light wakes a person up more easily?
Probably, but I am that's probably mostly related to just general weakening and aging of the pineal gland. That's the gland that it's hooked directly up to your retina. And light in your eyes stimulates the release of melatonin about 16 hours later, because we're built up for this 24-hour cycle. And when the threshold that the pineal gland produces melatonin and the amount that it's able to produce is going to change. So, for example, if your pineal gland becomes a little wimpy and doesn't produce as much melatonin, then you'll have more waking up in the middle of the night. It'll be harder to get back to sleep. And when you first start to get any photons going through your eyelids and hitting the retina in the morning, the melatonin levels immediately plummet. Now, if you're plummeting from a low level, you're going to wake up right away. If you're plummeting from a high level, it's going to take you longer to drop that melatonin to the point where you wake up. So I think, you know, just logically speaking, it's probably less testosterone, and maybe testosterone is a factor. I don't actually know about the influences that testosterone has on the pineal gland directly. I've never researched that particular connection.
Are there any things we can do in general for the pineal gland, since regardless of sleeping, the issue, it seems to be not quite as strong as you age?
Well, you know, supplemental melatonin is always on the table, but reducing the amount of light that you throw at your eyeballs for a couple of hours before bedtime is probably a good idea. And absolutely making the bedroom as dark as possible, or wearing a sleep mask is definitely worth a shot.
Interesting. I never have any trouble falling asleep. It's always within a minute or two. I should give workshops.
Well, then I would just wear a sleep mask and see whether or not that has an effect on it. And when you get up to pee in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. use an astronomer's red flashlight, because it's the blue light on the retina that affects the melatonin.
I just keep the lights out. There's enough ambient light.
Well, that's my problem. If you've got ambient light in your bedroom, you need to work on that.
Uh-huh.
So you should use a sleep mask and have it dark, and use a red light to go to the bathroom.
Interesting. I wonder if I can just get a sleep mask and extend the mask a little bit to cover my ears, and then I have to use earplugs, which I don't mind using. But
I don't know. Maybe you could try it.
Yeah.
See if it works. Let us know.
And then one last question.
Sure.
Do you need to go for someone else?
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
What about naps? What I had been hearing is that you need to have a certain amount of uninterrupted sleep for the different sleep cycles and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Can a nap? Does an hour long nap make up for an hour missed sleep during the night?
What does make up mean? Let me clarify. If you're doing tests of alertness and reaction time, because the military has been studying this for a while, it's obviously really important in combat pilots, flying missions, et cetera, and it turns out that if you're sleep deprived and you take a 45-minute nap, so that you don't get too deep, you don't get into REM sleep, and you don't get into stage 4 sleep in that 45 minutes, you improve your reaction time. If you actually get deeply asleep, so call it an hour and a half or an hour, maybe even an hour nap, there's a chance that you may reduce your alertness. So in terms of reaction time, testable reaction time and alertness, short naps, cat naps, 45 minutes or less, are helpful for keeping that going in a sleep-deprived young population. So I don't think I've ever seen research done on 50-year-old males. Most of them are not fighter pilots anymore. And so I don't know that anybody has really looked into that so carefully. By the way, are you don't snore, you're pretty clear that you don't have a sleep apnea issue?
I don't snore because I sleep on my side. That's why I sleep on my side.
So you might have some sleep apnea,
right,
if you slept on your back. And so that's also, of course, something that really starts to develop in males in their 50s. Even thin males can get it. And tissue relaxation is basically sag of the tissues in the throat. And sleep apnea will definitely have all kinds of effects on quality of sleep.
The sleep apnea, there are times when, there have been a few times in the last 5 years when I will jerk awake, and I'm really aware of that. And it feels like it's a sleep, breathing thing, because I'm like, I'm hyperventilating.
Yeah, so.
I'm breathing really deep, you know, hyperventilating.
That's fishy. You might want to ask to get screened.
But normally it's not a problem.
That
it's very rare to have that.
Yeah. But you may be, there's people who get that once a week or once a month, but then if you test them, they're semi-suffocating for, you know, 10% of the 10% of the night. They've got oxygen levels below 90, that they're just not waking. They're not waking up all the way. So, I mean, read up on sleep apnea symptoms a little bit. You know, it's the afternoon drowsiness. It's falling asleep in a, you know, it's 4 p.m. You're in a lecture hall. They turn down the lights and you're out. You're sleep deprived. And if you're a 50-year-old male, then sleep apnea needs to be ruled out. That's, you fall asleep driving at all ever, without being, you know, drunk. Then which you shouldn't be driving, obviously, if you've had too much alcohol. The implication is that you're sleep deprived and should be tested for sleep apnea.
Is the only solution for that though the mask?
No, there are surgeries. They're about 50% effective. I mean, they're effective in 50% of people who get them, I should say. When they're effective, they're pretty much 100% right, effective. And sometimes what they do is they just carve away at the back of the palate and take away your uvula. And that's enough to create a passageway that doesn't close at night.
Gosh, you've been really helpful, as always.
Well, thank you, and happy to have the opportunity to help. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. I have an off-air question. I have retinitis pigmentosa. I got Cialis, but it says I shouldn't take it if I have that. Why? Well, we know that all of the drugs, Viagra, Cialis, Levitra, these are agents that have an impact on nitric oxide. They're phosphodiesterase inhibitors, and we think that they would potentially affect blood flow to the retina, and we don't want to do that in anybody. There have been reports of people having changes in their color vision, testable deterioration of their color vision with the use of these agents. And you know, that old thing about masturbation making you go blind, of course, that's a myth, but the idea that it's kind of ironic that the drugs that are for erections may, in fact, have an effect on vision, it's just kind of odd. But that's the reason, and you probably want to follow that advice. Let's go to Frank in Mountain View. Hello, Frank. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. What can I do for you today?
So recently I got diagnosed with cancer in my bladder and throughout my abdomen. And just yesterday I started chemo. And I was just wondering, with the medication that I'm taking and the cancer that I have, if you have any suggestions.
Oh, well, that's a very broad question. What is the chemotherapy that you're taking?
I have two medications. One is gemcitabine.
Gemcitabine. Yes.
And the other one is cisplatin.
And cisplatin. Okay. First of all, this, I need to just preface this by saying that it's important to work with your oncologist and follow through on the recommendations that you've been given, because it sounds like the bladder cancer has gotten loose and has metastasized. And are these abdominal metastases on the bowel or in the lymph nodes? Do you know that?
My understanding, it's on the bowels and the lymph nodes.
Okay. So that is, you know, that's pretty advanced. And the most important thing in the initial stages is to... Did you smoke? I mean, did you used to smoke?
No.
And that's good, because if you were, I would definitely say to stop smoking immediately. You're on one of the more common chemotherapies, and there are a few things that can be beneficial. These are alternative things, and I can't really do this on the air because it's, you know, for obvious reasons, every case in a situation like this needs to be individualized. But broad strokes, you want to substantially reduce the sugar and the carbohydrates in your diet. This is something that seriously disadvantages cancer cells. So you would want to push the starch and the sugar way down and try to subsist primarily on protein, fat, and vegetables. And not even the starchy vegetables like potatoes and carrots. So things that grow above the ground like the leafy greens. If you eat fruits, can be eaten, but you shouldn't be juicing them. You shouldn't be having that much concentrated sugar that you would get from, say, making apple juice. That's like three whole apples to get a glass of apple juice. And so if you wanted to have one piece of fruit in a smoothie with some protein powder, that'd be okay. But you wouldn't want to concentrate fruit juice. And many people think that juicing is all good for cancer. But to the extent that you are adding a lot of fructose to that juicing, that is not all good because it helps fuel the cancer. Another basic natural medicine thing to do is look at your vitamin D levels and make sure that your vitamin D is in the 70s. Your level might be normal at 30 or 35, and that's great if you don't have metastatic cancer. But when you have metastatic cancer, there, vitamin D at high levels has some anti-cancer properties related to literally cellular signaling to the immune system to go and eat those cancers. So you want to be stimulating your immune system. And as you're on drugs that will drop the absolute amount of white blood cells, because unfortunately the immune system is vulnerable to some of the chemo drugs that we use, you'll want to do immune boosting. And I think, based on my reading of the literature, that the use of mushroom extracts is a pretty broadly safe and useful thing that doesn't interfere, that nobody's ever found interferes with chemotherapy. So I feel like that, without doing the specific research on those agents, that would take me some time and I can't do it off the top of my head, those are all things that you could do that would benefit you and would not step on your drug therapy.
So I would need to increase my vitamin D to about 70.
Yes, the blood
and
level.
In addition to that would be the mushroom extract.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those would be two good things to do. And the dietary thing, essentially what you want is anything that needs anything that can be metabolized by the cancer cells, which is primarily lose the ability to use the mitochondria properly, so they end up just doing bacterial type glycolytic metabolism, and so that's inefficient. And you can exploit the fact that they are not efficient at using calories by reducing sugar. That takes away the strength. The sugar and starch are what they need to grow, and so essentially you're interfering with their ability to thrive. And that's, I think, a very useful thing. Now, while you're doing chemo, and this is unknown, and so I'll just put it out there as this is an unknown, that maybe what we want to do when you're doing chemo is feed your body the most, you know, nothing but sugar, because then the cancer cells will grow really quickly. And then because they're growing really quickly, we can kill them better with our chemo. You could make that argument. I think it's a crazy argument. And I don't subscribe to that, but I could see a very by-the-book oncologist saying, well, until we've studied this, we shouldn't go there. I disagree. I think that a low sugar diet is a good idea when you have cancer, regardless of your stage of therapy.
Would that be day of my chemo, or would that be like a day before?
I don't think I'm not recommending you do that. I think it's a crazy idea. I think it's a crazy idea. I'm saying somebody your oncologist might, you know, make the oncology is kind of a fear-based type of medicine. People are they feel very comfortable doing the standard therapies, which is appropriate. These have been studied and they're scientifically derived and they're the best that we have at the moment. But it feels very weird to do anything else to them, including things that would seem to be no-brainers, like improve the diet and support the system. But they're making the scientific quibble that, well, if that wasn't done in the study, then how do we know that that won't interfere with the effectiveness? And you can't prove a negative. And, of course, no one's going to do a diet study in cancer. It's very hard to do diet studies at all. And so what studies we have are small and can be rightly criticized for not being properly controlled, because the only way you can control diet in humans is lock them up in a motel room and control everything they eat. And you're not going to do that in cancer patients. So, again, we're stuck with animal studies supporting these concepts. And by the way, all of the animal studies do support these concepts. But we don't have human studies. And to convince an oncologist to change their practice, that's what we would need.
Yeah.
All righty.
Okay.
Thank you, and good luck. Any last questions?
A couple more. So you said to increase my protein and my vegetables. There was something else you said to increase. I didn't get the third.
Well, you can live on protein, fat, and vegetables. And healthy fats like fish oil, avocados, walnuts, things like that are good nutritional sources. They won't kick up your cholesterol. And they are not digestible by cancer cells.
Okay. So we want to take away their food.
Yeah. I mean, basically, we don't want you losing weight.
The sugars.
Yeah. Exactly. We don't want you losing weight at this point unless you're super overweight. So you're going into chemo. You're going to lose some weight. We don't want you to lose more weight. And if you just go on a vegetable and protein diet, that's called a paleo diet. It's a great way to lose weight. So I'm encouraging you to throw in some healthy fats so that you maintain your weight.
Got it.
Okay. All right.
And then with protein, is that just for me to that, or would protein shakes also help?
I like protein shakes. I think that, you know, pushing the protein high and so that you're not just using it for building material, but you're actually using it for calories is a really good way to go. You need to be sure that your kidney function is good. You need to be sure you hydrate adequately, because protein, along for the ride comes nitrogen. Your body has to get rid of that nitrogen, and it does it through the kidneys. So if your kidneys aren't good, then that's a problem. But otherwise, it's well tolerated. Just be sure you get plenty of fluid.
Yeah, and my doctors have checked in. You know, my kidneys are fine.
Good.
Up to now, so.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, cisplatin is hard on the kidneys, so they'll continue to monitor that.
Oh, good. And then with the vitamin D, would a multivitamin suffice to get my vitamin D? Because right now I think it's at 20, and I know that's low.
No, you're going to need 70. Yeah, you're going to need, a multivitamin won't come close. You're going to need, you know, 4,000 or 5,000. Units. And the Institute of Medicine says 4,000 a day is safe for anybody for long-term use. So you could do 4,000 or 5,000 for a couple of months and then look at the level again. I wouldn't take over. I never recommend more than about 10,000 a day, and I don't recommend that except under supervision of a functional medicine doctor, because you need to monitor calcium levels and you need to monitor that vitamin D level. You don't want to go toxic on it.
Okay.
All right. So there are details here, but in broad strokes, 5,000 units a day will get you up, probably get you up to 70 in 3 months.
Okay.
Alrighty.
And the mushroom extract, is there like a dose for that, or is it self-explanatory when I find it?
It's pretty self-explanatory. You follow the recommended doses. You can search the particular thing. Like if you're on a shiitake, you can Google search, scholar.google.com and look at the doses of that were used in the studies, and then try to achieve those doses in yourself. That's the best way to do it.
Okay.
All right.
And then, can I ask you one more thing?
Sure.
Okay. So when I started having symptoms, one thing that I did notice, I won't give you all the details how I found it, but I found a worm after having had a bowel movement. I mentioned it to the doctors, and now we're studying. I'm just wondering, is there, they're checking to see if I also have a parasite in addition to the cancer. Is there anything you can think of that I can be doing at home in the meantime while getting the results of that? Or even even once I get the results of that, whether it's positive or negative, just in case there is a parasite?
Well, worms are one of the many different kinds of parasites. It depends on around if it's a roundworm or an ascaris or something like that. There are specific therapies based on what kind of worm it is. Sometimes people can see things that are vegetable fibers or stuff that they've consumed that was undigestible, like a little rubber band or something that got into the broccoli. And it can look like a worm by the time it comes out the other end. So the first thing to do is to really confirm that you're dealing with worms. Most of the time... Yeah, most of the time you're not. Most of the time it's an artifact. But if it really is, then the eggs and specific findings will be there to confirm that. And then you treat as appropriate. But no, I wouldn't do any kind of natural, I wouldn't start taking artemisia or oregano oil or any of the other things that you'll find in a web search to get rid of, quote unquote, get rid of parasites, because all of these things disrupt the microbiome and you don't want to do that unnecessarily.
Okay.
All right. Have a really, I want to wish you a side effect free chemotherapy session, and I sincerely hope that your tumors shrink rapidly.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I know it's day two or day three when I might start feeling the side effects of the chemo. So far, so good. And then if you had any recommendations for the side effects, the nausea, I do have medication for that I'm on a schedule for, but then they also gave me some medicine for as needed. So hopefully that'll take care of it. But if there was anything else you could recommend, that'd be great.
Well, I think that the slam dunk best alternative therapy for nausea, and in fact, there are actual pharmaceutical agents derived from the cannabinoids. But those agents, you know, like the Marinol, are really very good as second line agents. So if you're not, basically, if hitting the regular medullary receptors of the nausea center isn't working for you, go hit the cannabinoid receptors, and you can do that with pharmaceuticals, or you can do it with medical marijuana. And in California, at least, it's legal for me to say that. So that's my response.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. Good luck.
Well, thank you so much. Bye-bye. Have a good day.
You too. So let's see. I had an off-air question. Do I know anything about Niagen for mitochondrial health? And yes, Niagen is a form of nicotinamide. Nicotinamide is the basic building block for NADH, which is one of the electron transporters in the mitochondria. So again, if you want your mitochondria to work well, you need a whole bunch of bucket carriers to carry the electrons down the chain. And so having more NAD and NADH up to a point is really good for you. Once you're full, you're full, but it doesn't hurt to have extra precursor around. And certainly if there's a deficiency, you're going to see rather astonishing improvement when you replace. When there's not a deficiency, there's a point of sufficiency where further replacement doesn't do anything. But there's definitely a middle range where you can get some improvement in the functioning by adding substrate. So go give it a try. You know, see if you notice an improvement. See if you can test with organic acid testing to see whether things are working better or not. So if you have the money to do additional testing, you can actually do a before and after and look for improvement. Let's go now to Judy in Capitola. Hello, Judy. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
I have what I hope is a simple question about platelet counts.
Sure.
Recently had just a regular yearly 6-month blood test, and my platelet count came out at 122.
Mm-hmm.
So the doctor asked me to repeat it, which I did about a month after that one, and they said the platelets were clumping too much to do a count, but they said they were adequate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 72, and I have 10 years of data on platelet counts. I keep all my old blood tests.
Yeah. So have you?
So they've never been that low.
Have they kind of been on the low end of the reference range, though?
No. Last year it was 194, and before 221.
All right. So
I've had the clumping thing maybe about once every 5 years.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, it's a lump of platelets, so how many, you know, how many marbles in a lump? Well, here's the scoop. It should be monitored. You've got plenty of platelets from the standpoint of letting your blood clot. And if they're seeing clumps, your platelets may be kind of hyper. When I see something like that, I often wonder if I'm not looking at the body's wisdom to sort of reduce the number of platelets because they're extra sticky.
Oh.
And the body says, oh, well, these guys are working a little too well. I guess I don't need quite as many of them. So that's, you know, one potential interpretation of this. You do see reduced platelets in certain pre-disease states, myelofibrosis, for example, where you're getting some scar tissue in the bone marrow. But usually you'll also see changes in the other blood markers, the white blood cells in particular, under that circumstance. And the emergence of irregularly shaped red blood cells is also something to watch for there. So more than likely, this is nothing to worry about and can simply be monitored. When the platelets get really low, it can indicate an immune attack. And so if they're continuing to drop, you may need to get checked for ITP, which is an immune attack on the platelets. But you can't make that diagnosis with platelets of 120. It would be like under 100, and that would be the point where you'd be saying, what's up with this, and start to investigate.
Well, I was just being concerned in that I'm 72 and there's a family history of stroke, and I'm in better health than anybody.
Well, let's put it this way. Low platelets are going to reduce your risk of stroke.
Oh, okay.
But if the platelets are low because your platelets are super sticky,
yeah,
that super sticky might be the inherited stroke risk right there.
Oh.
So you might want to consider getting... Do you take any anti-inflammatories or aspirin?
I can't. It thins my blood really fast.
Mm-hmm.
I can't use the...
Yeah, you probably have some genetic mutations in the platelet system, it sounds to me. And you know, not a named thing. You know, we're getting there in terms of our genetic understanding of these diseases. But it sounds to me like you're a bit of an outlier in terms of your function. But so you would want to be careful. You might consider something called natokinase. This is an enzyme. One brand name is serrapeptidase. And this is an enzyme that comes from soy that breaks down fibrin in the bloodstream. And so it might be actually a little bit helpful in reducing your stroke risk. And it doesn't act on platelets, so it acts on the other part of the blood clotting system. So it's protective, but it wouldn't thin your blood or have an impact on your platelets.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be this is logical, but there's not a double-blind, placebo-controlled study saying that this will work. It is, on the other hand, a harmless food product extract, and I don't think it'll hurt you.
So they have that at the
health food store. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
NATTO?
Natokinase.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. So off air from Anne in Carmel Valley, she was told to take 2,400 milligrams of ibuprofen for 3 weeks for inflamed plantar fascia. I weigh 110 pounds. Is that safe? It is a safe dose. It's on the high end, but where I would worry about it having an effect on the GI tract, maybe risking ulcers or GI bleeding. Definitely take something like that with food. And for plantar fascia, I usually would use massage and stretching and icing, and I rarely use oral anti-inflammatories anymore because I'm so aware of their negative effect on the GI tract, and the fact that we have 50,000 people admitted to the hospital every year as a direct result of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory use makes me think twice, just like my understanding of the microbiome over the last 10 years has made me really think twice about antibiotics and ask myself, do I really need to use this? Is there any other way? Because I know there's a downside to this that is going to have an adverse effect on the individual, at least somewhat. And do I want to give them that risk? Is the benefit worth it? So I don't use either of those agents on a just-in-case basis anymore. I have to know there's going to be a big benefit. And I think you can address plantar fasciitis in a few other ways. We have time for just a real quick story here at the end of the hour. So let me tell you about a new thing using Google Glass. Google Glass, you may know, is a little, looks like a pair of weird-looking glasses, but it's actually got a screen that can project. People can read text messages, but it's clear so they can see through it. Sort of like the military screens on the fighter jets, actually. Anyway, at this hospital, residents would, in the emergency room at University Mass Memorial Medical Center, used Google Glass to perform toxicology consults. So they would put on their Google Glass. These were medical ER physicians and medical residents. And they would go into evaluate the patients. And they would take pictures of the medication bottles, and the consultant could see them do the physical exam. They could look at the, they could see the echocardiograms and give other information, and the toxicologists could type on a screen, and questions or check this, check that would appear in the resident's field of view, and that would modulate their exam. And what they found was that there were a lot of improvements. 89% of the cases, the consultant made additional suggestions, changed the management of more than half of the cases from what it would ever otherwise be. So this is a real proof of concept. If you're that lonely emergency room doctor out there at, oh, let's pick a hospital I worked at once, Hazel Hawkins in Hollister, small little emergency room, you're it, the only doctor on, and someone rolls in with an overdose of six agents, and you're like calling the poison control center to figure out what you should do. Should you induce vomiting? Should you lavage? Should you give charcoal? Are there antidotes? It's awfully nice to have an expert who can be looking literally over your shoulder and helping you out. This is the beginning of telemedicine. It's definitely a valid proof of concept. Stay tuned for more, and join me next week for more Ask Dr. Dawn. It's been a pleasure spending this hour with you. So long, and stay healthy.